I've been driven by romance and travel. I've enjoyed radio, but I've been driven by other things. I'd always wanted to work on a barrier reef island or on a desert island. I was terrified of him, really. I found him quite intimidating.
Conversations, an occasional radio moment series in which we talk to those who made a difference. Nick Bailey.
I was born in London. My father was the late actor Robin Bailey. And I was sent, as was the fashion at the time, to the Lycée Français de Londres, because it was fashionable to have your children bilingual. So I was there from 5 to 11. At the age of 11, my father got offered the job of playing the part of Professor Higgins in the original Australian production of My Fair Lady. Off he went to Melbourne on a P&O ship. My father had flown out beforehand, so this was 1958. I went with my mother and my younger brother, and we arrived in Melbourne in a heat wave. For me, it was so hot I couldn't go outside because I couldn't breathe. But I was accepted by the Australians at school. I probably had quite a plummy English accent, but I was accepted and I enjoyed the school. I went to South Yarra Grammar School in Melbourne, and we were there for about 15 months, I suppose, and then we were sent to Sydney. I was that much older. Sorry to leave Melbourne because I had lots of friends, but I soon got into the Sydney way of life. And although Melbourne is a more attractive city per se, you can't beat the harbour and the beaches that Sydney has to offer. And I went to a couple of state schools there, one of which, the later one, was Hunters Hill High School, lovely old part of Sydney. I made many, many friends. And it was at the age of 14 that I first got the idea of working in radio. Not that I thought it would ever happen, because it's rather like saying you want to be a film star, but I was listening to commercial radio, and in particular to John Laws, who is still going strong at the age of 82.
I am going to stop being a radio broadcaster. I will never stop totally thinking of it, because apart from my family, it's been my life for 55 years. I mean, I've loved every moment I've spent in radio. I loved every broadcast I've ever done from any place in Australia or even overseas.
And I thought, this must be a wonderful job, because you're playing the music that you love, and you're holding court for several hours, and it's just you. It's just you and that other person. My father had a tape recorder, and I used the tape recorder to make up my own radio station, which I called Radio XYZ. My father had had the album Songs for Swinging Cellars, so I was doing little bits of radio with pop tunes plus clips of comedy.
I can see you're like me. I will not go into a public park and mingle with a hoi polloi.
I quite agree. I like to keep myself to myself.
Sydney is a fabulous town. It really is a fabulous town. It's people busy but so friendly.
I was almost 15 years old and my father decided it was time to come back to this country. And I hated leaving Australia. The idea of coming back to the UK with its cold weather and all my friends were in Australia and so on. Went to the local comprehensive school, which I didn't like, and didn't do well at school. Left just before I was 17. I took my O-levels again, but failed. So my father suggested I do a job. Now, his agent at the time was the same agent of Bernard Miles of Mermaid Theatre fame. And I went for an interview, and his daughter, Sally Miles, and her husband, Gerald Frau, who was at that stage running the publicity department of Mermaid Theatre. And they were looking for someone to be their assistant. And I was interviewed for that job, and I got the job. And so I was in Plymouth, and this was in 1964. And I was there for about 8 months. The company folded, but Gerald went back to the Mermaid as head of the publicity department, and I became his assistant. And during that time, I had realised I'd inherited my father's voice. I knew I sounded like my father because whenever I was at their home and I picked up the phone, even if it was his agent, he'd say, "Oh, hi, Robin." And in fact, it was me. And they had used me to do the interval announcements on tape to say, "Ladies and gentlemen, there's now an interval of 15 minutes. Ice creams are now being sold, you know, etc." So I knew I'd developed his voice, which my two younger brothers certainly hadn't. And I was incredibly shy because I'd never, people asked me, did I ever want to be an actor? No, I never did, because I always shied away from school productions. But anyway, moving to Plymouth, I was just before 17. I enjoyed that. And there was a Tasmanian actor who had been travelling the world and ended up in London working at the box office at the Mermaid Theatre. His name was Bob Larkins. And he had been a radio actor. I think the box office job was just a stopgap. But he got a job as a copywriter and eventually a newsreader on Radio Caroline South. And this was in 1966.
Newsbeat. Bringing news to the nation. This is Radio Caroline Newsbeat, fast and factual.
Liverpool. Police are still searching over a wide area of the northwest for five prisoners who escaped from Walton Jail in Liverpool.
I knew of it, but I was listening to Radio London, which I actually thought was a better station. It had better jingles and better disc jockeys, I thought. So he told me about these jobs, and I went for an audition for a chap called Graham Webb, who was known as Graham Spider Webb. And he had become the news director. And I did the audition, which I failed. But he said, if you, you know, go away and practice and come back in a few weeks, who knows, you know, if the job's still open. I took him at his word, and I was living with an actor who had a tape recorder, and I practiced and practiced with this single sheet of news. And after 3 weeks, I did phone him. I spoke to Graham Webb, but we got talking, and he said, yes, I do remember you, once I prodded him. And he said, well, the jobs are still going. And so I did go in again. Caroline House in Mayfair, very posh establishment. I don't think Ronan O'Reilly, who was the man who founded Radio Caroline, I don't know whether he owned it, he must have leased it, I suppose. That's where I had my second audition. It satisfied Graham. He said, I've just got to pass it through Ronan O'Reilly, which he did, and Ronan O'Reilly approved. And I was sent out to the South Ship. So this was in September 66. I mean, nerve-wracking in a way, but very, very exciting. Because in the run-up to me getting this job, I started to listen to Radio Caroline, and I got to like their disc jockeys and what they were doing and so on. So I got very much into it. And actually, to arrive on the ship and be part of the setup.
Well, that's only part one, and there's another part two on the other side of that. It's by the Flowerpot Men on DRM record label, and it's called Let's Go to San Francisco. 13 minutes now after 9 o'clock on the Sound of the Nation.
When I arrived, there was David Lee Travis, Michael Hearn, Robbie Dale, Steve Young was a Canadian overnight. There was Kiefer's, also Canadian. There was Tom Lodge, that's right, he was there. He was the chief disc jockey. And I arrived on the day that Roscoe left. Now, on those, and Roscoe, I remember him giving up his place for me at the lunchtime table, because as we came on board, others left off, got off for their leave. As far as everyone knew, he was just going off for his week's leave, but he never came back. I had a little bit of an initiation ceremony there, because I think within a couple of days, I was chased up the mast by David Lee Travis and Robbie Dale, had my trousers pulled down, and they had waited specifically for the tourist boat that came out. You paid your money in Felixstowe in this case, and you came out and had a look at the ship. And so that was quite an event. I didn't really like the South Ship. I was very excited to be on board, but I found the egos really, I didn't find them very friendly. I found Tom Lodge very friendly, and I liked him very much, and Steve Young, but some of the others, I found that the egos were just a little bit too much. And I realised one of the reasons for this was because they were being heard in London, and so they were under a lot of pressure. But when I was subsequently sent to the North Ship, which happened after a month, and the reason for that was that Graham Webb, having been asked to expand the newsroom, was then told, no, he had to cut two places, he had to cut it by two, because I think Radio London was eating into their income and they had to make cutbacks. So he got round it. I mean, I should have been the one, because I was last in. I should have been the one to go. So I had the rest of my pirate radio time on the North Ship, which I loved because it was a much bigger ship. I had a cabin on my own. The dining room was much bigger. There was a table tennis table. There was, it made its own bread. We had chickens on board. We had kippers, Max kippers for breakfast. It was just a wonderful experience. And I got on with everyone. Jerry Layton was the chief disc jockey on that. But my job was to record the BBC News or Voice of America. I must admit, we tended to rely mostly on the BBC. And rewrite it. And then broadcast it. And I think on the breakfast show, there was probably news every half hour. And then it was on the hour throughout the day. And then there was a sort of long half hour news, I think, at 6 o'clock.
morning, this is Nick Bailey with the 8 o'clock news bulletin. The Isle of Man. Support continues to pour in from all over the world for the Isle of Man and their fight for freedom. Member nations of the Committee for Colonialism at the United Nations have pledged their support for the island. And
the only thing I had in my armoury was that I... One of the things I had learnt was I'd learnt how to touch type. And so that was just incredibly useful. I mean, I listen back to the tapes now, and although I sound sort of BBC World Service-ish, it sounds quite professional, actually, funny enough. I suppose I had plenty of time. I mean, I recorded at 5, and I think the first news was at 6. But it was just a very exciting time. All the usual things happened. Mick Lubsett, who was the afternoon presenter, tried to burn my news. We had them on individual strips of paper, so you just had to read more and more quickly to stop the flames taking over altogether. Tony Prince would do rude things with the fire hose and all sorts of things, you know, try and trip you up. But it was just a great sense of camaraderie and a wonderful time on board. Caroline. When Pirate Radio was set up, it was quite a clever ploy by Ronan O'Reilly. He'd looked at the law that you could broadcast into the UK in this case, providing you were 3 miles out or more of the UK's territorial waters. And they couldn't arrest you on board, and they couldn't arrest you when you came ashore. They could arrest you, in theory, if the ship drifted and went within that 3 mile limit. What the Act did, or that they could arrest you when it came ashore, so that you were an outlaw, but they couldn't do anything while you were in the international waters, but they could do something when you stepped foot in the UK. Similarly, they could also prosecute the advertisers. And that's where it all fell flat, because, you know, we had advertising right up to the last day, but as soon as it was illegal, they all jumped ship, if I can use that expression. I think initially maybe we were hopeful, and Ronan O'Reilly came out about a few months before the Marine Broadcasting Offences Act was passed. It didn't look hopeful that the Act wouldn't be passed. I mean, I think we knew that was going to be passed, whatever. But I was looking forward to the prospect of maybe living in Amsterdam or Paris and continuing. But when Ronan O'Reilly came out a few months before the Act was passed, I felt he was just bluffing, really, as to how this was going to work in terms of money and all sorts of things. And we were beginning to take on presentation staff who I didn't think were very good at all. And I thought, this is the beginning of the end. We skip the light fandango. Turns cartwheels across the floor. The Act came into place on the 14th of August, although it didn't actually come into play on the Isle of Man, I think, until the end of August. But the way my shift pattern worked, I left on the 8th with Jerry Layton, and we never came back. I think it was just that I felt that professionally it wouldn't be the same, it wouldn't be as good. It's strange, isn't it? Because I had a return ticket, I was getting paid very well I was 20 by that stage, but I was getting paid extremely well, £25 a week. So I was coming off the ship with £75. And to put that into context, my rent, and I was living in Hampstead in London, was £2.50 a week. So, you know, I managed to save a lot of money. I had a Kodak Instamatic, and I made a concerted effort to take lots of pictures, still pictures. And also, I borrowed my mother's movie camera, and I took on two consecutive times on Caroline in the summer of 67, I took footage. And I give talks for P&O, and I play it back to back with the trailer for The Boat That Rocked, and there are great similarities. And I'm one of the few people who actually thought The Boat That Rocked was good. I mean, it had its faults, it was a bit long, but actually, considering Richard Curtis was 11 when he started listening to pirate radio, and it was his 11-year-old's imagination of what pirate radio was, I thought it was a pretty good film.
But they risked it all.
You can't do this.
Why not? We're pirates. That's why we're sitting out here in the middle of the friggin' ocean.
For the music they love.
So I get off the ship, 8th of August. Now, I'd already made plans because prior to getting off in August, I had actually taken leave and I decided to go to Cornwall. I was going to travel with my French girlfriend at the time, but we had a big argument, so we didn't. But I still went myself. And one of the places I went to was Newquay. And I sat on the beach with the surf coming in. And it reminded me of Sydney in Australia and how much I'd enjoyed Australia. and how it was through Australia, A, that I got into radio in the first place, and B, that it was an Australian who employed me. And I thought, well, why don't I emigrate to Australia? So once I got off the ship, I mean, fairly soon after that, I went to Australia House and got an interview. I mean, in those days, they took anybody. I mean, what was I? I was an out-of-work radio announcer, as far as they're concerned. I'd saved £500 whilst on Caroline, which was a lot of money then. In the meantime, I went for a holiday in Morocco. I went to Tangier, where I had some friends, an artist and his girlfriend. And I stayed with them actually for 6 weeks. And I got the idea of bringing back various items, in particular puffs, which I could then sell. Well, they were quite smart. They weren't the garish puffs that you see these days. These were actually quite smart. But we had to find a way of stuffing them, so we stuffed them with newspaper. We bought them for £1, sold them for £3. Well, that was fine, because we weren't paying any tax in that first lot. But they were going so well, and we had some other items as well. We had hats, we had some basket, we had beads, which we all managed to get through customs, saying they were gifts for friends. We thought, well, let's try and do this seriously. So we went to, and can you imagine this these days? This was my friend and myself, and we took two stuffed puffs. We went on the bus with no prior appointment, and we went to Harrods. And so we walked in and said, can we see the buyer? And we were immediately shown to where the buyer was for, I suppose, upholstery. And they loved them. And they ordered a gross. So what is a gross? 144. So we thought, well, that's fantastic. But we thought, now we need one more big hitter. So the next one was John Lewis. So there we were again, my friend and I, two stuffed puffs on the bus. So the head of soft furnishings came along and he said, oh, this is wonderful. He said, can I just try something though? So he took his handkerchief out and he licked it and then he went on the puff and the dye came off. He said, that won't do. He was very nice about it, but he said, I'm afraid, you know, we have some very high-class customers and we don't want to be caught up in them suing us by ruining their dresses and so on. But he said, if you find a way of making the dye fast, then we can think again. But that really killed it. And also at that stage, I was rapidly running out of money. I was very tempted to stay because I was in love with a French girlfriend at the time. And I was loving this backwards and forwards to Morocco and doing all this stuff. But in the end, no, I thought, I think the head ruled the heart. And I thought, no, let's continue with my original plan of emigrating to Australia, which I did on, I think it was February the 18th, so just over 50 years ago as I speak. And it was the £10 scheme. And the stipulation was you had to stay 2 years. You could come back before that, but if you did, you had to pay back the Australian government. So in Australia, I was met by Graham Webb, and I did apply for various newsreading posts in Sydney, but didn't get them, partly because I was too English, and also I didn't know about Australian news and all that sort of thing. I think Graham Webb asked me to do, suggested I do some modelling, which I had all the pictures taken, but I didn't get any jobs through it.
McCartney's on 2SM, look up in the sky. Is it a plane? Is it a bird? Is it a plane bird? No, it's Sunshine Superman, 21-1.
But it was Ian McCrae, who was on Radio City, who became a big name in Australia on 2SM doing the breakfast show. He had, after Radio City closed, he'd had a stint on Radio Caroline, and we got to know each other, although we didn't work together. He was on the South Ship, and he was often at Graham Webb's place in Sydney. And he said, to be honest, your best bet is to get experience in the country, in the bush. And I went to an announcing school just to get the feel of presenting, which was good for me. I think it's not good for other people. It wasn't like RADA where you were auditioned. They took anybody. I remember there was a poor chap with a speech impediment who would never make it in radio, but they gladly took his money. So I looked daily in the Sydney Morning Herald, and the job in a place called Moree came up, 2VM Moree, 400 miles northwest of Sydney, the Wheat and Wool Centre of New South Wales, town of 10,000 people. I arrived in October of 68. So by that stage, I had a slight Australian accent, but obviously enough for them to think I'd be acceptable. Again, I've been so lucky with friends because I had a friend, although I emigrated by myself, I met various guys on the ship and we all shared a house in Sydney. And one of them had a tape recorder. Why he had a tape recorder, goodness knows, but anyway, he had one. And so that was very useful. And I remember I made various domestic tapes, one of which I sent to Katoomba in the Blue Mountains. I remember them phoning me and they said, G'day, Mick. We've got your tape, but there's nothing on it. And I said, well, there must be, because, you know, it sounded fine when I checked back. But somehow the one I sent to 2BM Moree managed to get through and they could hear it. And I loved it. I was there for 8 months. But I realised that in Australian radio, I was 21 by this stage, in Australian radio, you need to move fast. If you stay just in the one place, I mean, you'll never get anywhere. And I had always had this romantic image of North Queensland. And so I applied for a job in Townsville, which I got. It was a much bigger city. I think even in those days, 200,000 people now, but even in those days, it was 100,000. It was the second city of Queensland. So from an experience point of view, it was wonderful. I was there for 18 months. But Townsville was not the romantic image of North Queensland at all. It's very dry and it's wasn't very attractive. But I got to know North Queensland. But I had a range of experience there. I mean, I did Open Line. I did a Saturday evening programme, which included sport. But I primarily did the breakfast show. And I did that for certainly half the time that I was there. But then I got fed up. I felt I was doing, in those days you worked 6 days a week. Well, officially you went to be there at five to turn the transmitter on and then play test music for half an hour and then play country and western music for half an hour. And then it started proper at six, but I never got there before six. But at the weekends, the breakfast show was 6 to 11. So that was a long stint. And I was sort of knackered after that. I got fed up. That's why I felt it was sort of slave labour in a way. The money wasn't that brilliant. I've been driven by romance and travel, really. I mean, I've enjoyed radio, but I've been driven by other things. I'd always wanted to work on a barrier reef island or on a desert island. And there's an island called Dunk Island, which is absolutely beautiful, in tropical paradise. And I had a friend who was working there. And I thought, I just want to get out of this radio business and work on this island. And I got a job and told the boss, and he was amazed. Because I think we were the top-rated breakfast show. We were beating the other. He couldn't understand why I wanted to leave, to work as an odd-job man on this island. And so I was there on Dunk Island for a month, but I was useless at the job. So I resigned before I knew I was going to be fired. And then what was I going to do? So I ended up in Sydney. So I applied for a job in a bookshop. I'd hardly read a book in my life, but anyway, I got the job. Within a few months, I was made head of paperbacks. I mean, this is the thing about Australia. You can sort of move very quickly. And I was enjoying the job, and I met my first wife there. But then suddenly, after about 10 months after I'd made the application to 4BH in Brisbane, they wrote to me and said, are you still interested? By this stage, much as I enjoyed the bookshop job, I thought, yes, no, I am interested. And it was for a late-night programme, reading the news statewide, going to all the commercial stations in Queensland, of which there were many. So off I went to Brisbane.
Good morning, starshine. The earth says hello.
It's 8:82 a.m. and good morning from 4BH, bright and beautiful music.
I was lucky to survive because in Australia, I think they're just about to change the rules here, but in Australia, for years and years and years, you could change format overnight. So you could be pop one day and then we'd decide to go all talk. Or in this case, it was super oldies, and then they decided to go jazz. Well, a lot of the people around me got fired because their voice didn't suit, but my voice suited jazz. And I think I was taken on primarily for the news reading, but they wanted someone who could do both. Once I got the job in Brisbane, I had already decided I wanted, after a year, to start travelling. I was getting itchy feet. And that's what I did after a year in Brisbane. So I left in Australia in October of 72. I was armed with, there was a presenter at 4BH who had worked in Hong Kong, at Radio Hong Kong. I managed to get a ticket valid for a year. I thought, well, I'll go to Hong Kong. And I had the list of names given to me by this guy. So I went to Radio Hong Kong, and the first name on the list, the man had died. And the second name on the list, the man had retired. And the third name on the list was a chap called Geoffrey Weeks, who had just taken over as head of English radio. And he was an interesting character because he was also an actor. He trained at RADA. He still continued his acting career, and he played a main part in Bruce Lee's Enter the Dragon. He played the M character. So he was there. He said, we just happened to be holding auditions. So I think this is fantastic. They've just arrived in Hong Kong. They're holding auditions on Monday. So on the Monday, I was auditioned. I remember I had to speak for a minute on Brisbane's main street, which was hard, because Brisbane in those days was a bit of a sort of backwater. But I passed the audition, And then I realised they held auditions every Monday because it was such a transient place in terms of, I mean, Hong Kong is a very transient place. And I had a great time in Hong Kong doing all sorts of things. That was where I had my first experience of broadcasting classical music, because they had FM and AM. And if I was doing the FM shift, it was a classical music programme in the morning. But I also did pop programmes. I read a lot of news. And I did voiceovers for their programme called Insight. So it was moving my career into a sort of different direction. It wasn't just pop. And I've always loved classical music. When I was 15, I joined a record library taking out classical records. But I also liked the Rolling Stones and the Beatles. So, I mean, my taste was very eclectic. And I had a great time in Hong Kong. There were some very interesting characters there. There was an American who did a programme who'd lost a leg in the Korean War. And we'd meet in the bar, and meet all these characters in the bar. He said, I live in a place called Palatine House. And he said, they do special discounts for artists. And so I went along to Palatine House, and yes, I got a discount. I got a bigger room and not paying as much rent. But I realised this was a genuine brothel, because I had a room with mirrors on the ceiling. But I didn't mind, because it was, again, a great atmosphere. So I had a great time in Hong Kong, but then moved on. And I suppose I had this idea of working in Bangkok, which was the next stop, and then Delhi, which was the stop after that, in radio. In All India Radio, I managed to see some bosses there, and they were very interested, but they said, we can't offer you anything. You can do a voluntary programme. But they did show me the piece of the microphone, which underneath had a piece of red carpet, I suppose, which is where Indira Gandhi, because she was the Prime Minister at the time, did her broadcast. So that was very, very interesting. Got back to the UK eventually in June of 73. And I have to say, one of the reasons for coming back when I did was the introduction of commercial radio in 73. So that was my original idea. Tried to get a job at LBC, but didn't get anywhere. Sent an audition tape to Capital. It was an audition tape from my days at Radio Hong Kong. That led to an interview with Michael Bucht, who I thought was a very strange man and rather charmless. But I thought I was doing quite well. I mean, you know, how much he asked questions like, how much do you want to earn? I mean, those sort of curveball questions. But it led to another audition, but this time sort of live, with Dave Cash, which I thought went very well. So I don't know how close I was, but I think I was reasonably close, but not close enough, obviously. The next station was Radio Clyde, and I thought I was a shoo-in there, because was it Andy Park and who was the boss? Jimmy Gordon actually came down to London to interview me, and they were talking about, well, we can give you this shift and that sort of thing. And I used it as a lever, actually, because I'd already applied to BFP, so eventually I did get into BFPS. I think I had an interview lined up for BRMB, but before that happened, BFPS came through. And I was in the very first batch of trainees, which included Sarah Kennedy, of Radio 2 fame, and Patrick Lunt, who worked at Radio 2 as well. There were six of us. I was lucky because the first batch of trainees was on word of mouth, and I only had two O-levels. The next batch of trainees, you had to have A-levels, and the next batch of trainees, you had to have a degree. So, very lucky to have got in. At the interview, they said, where do you want to go? And I said, well, I don't want Singapore because I've just been in Hong Kong. I said, well, Cyprus would be nice. But I got Gibraltar, which I had no regrets about at all, even though the border was closed at the time. So I was there for 2 years doing a variety of things. And being a trainee was actually very good because you learnt the trade in every shape and form. I mean, interviewing, DJing, classical music, everything. So I had 2 years there. Did my first Family Favourites from Gibraltar with Sandy Jones, I think it was.
Well, with Michael Aspel bronzing himself on some sun-drenched beach somewhere, it's my pleasure to sit in London and do a bit of Radio Globe.
And then I was sent to Cologne, had 2.5 years there, did Family Favourites there as well. And then I was sent to Berlin, and I was in Berlin for about 2.5 years. Berlin was seen as really the top position for someone of my grade. I mean, very glamorous and very exciting. So I was in charge of the radio station, but also on air. And some very exciting times. And because BFPS unofficially had 5 million German listeners, record companies fell over themselves to bring all the big acts to be interviewed live. And on the political front, all sorts of people came through as well because of what Berlin was. I mean, things I remember there, being at a cocktail party and having my 30 seconds with the general, his ADC coming up to him and saying, "There's been another escape, sir." You know, things. And I remember being phoned once by the security people saying that, because this was the time of the Baader-Meinhof gang, saying that we've got a tip-off to the Baader-Meinhof for going to attack media in Berlin. So that was a bit of a scary moment. But heady times, I have to say, Berlin, and my slot would broadcast throughout the whole of Germany. And I resigned, actually, because I wanted to go travelling. In the meantime, the boss of BFBS, a wonderful man called Ian Wolfe, after the war, he spoke fluent Italian. He interrogated Italian prisoners of war. I mean, he was just, and he'd been in the special operations executive. He persuaded me to go to Hong Kong to open up the English service of BFPS in Hong Kong. They already had a Gurkha service. And because of my Hong Kong experience, I thought, oh, this would be great to go back. So I did that. And then I was sent back to the UK on promotion, which I hated because there were no live programs in the UK. And BFPS had a merger, so it became very corporate. And I just didn't want management, really, I think. I just wanted to stay on air, or I didn't mind being program director, but I didn't really want to be management and out of programs altogether. Pretty soon after I got the job, I started negotiating to go back to Hong Kong, and this time with the original Radio Hong Kong, or Radio Television Hong Kong, as it had become, hoping in time to get an expatriate contract. But they said, "We've got nothing going. You can come here as a freelance, but you take a big risk." And at that stage, I had one child and another one on the way. But my wife, my then wife, was incredibly supportive. We decided just to go for it, which I did. I had a year freelancing. I got a job at TVB Pearl, the television station there, doing continuity, which paid pretty well. So I was getting paid quite well, but I had to pay for accommodation, which in Hong Kong is incredibly expensive. My career took a different direction then, because within a couple of years of working for Radio Television Hong Kong, I went into current affairs, and I set up the current affairs programme called Hong Kong Today in 1987 with the newsroom, and I co-presented it for the next 5 years. But in 1990, I became head of Radio 3, which was the English channel. So it was ironic, because I'd left BFBS, I didn't like management, but I'd gone back into management. You're in this catch-22 situation, aren't you, where to get more money, you need to be promoted. And if you don't get promoted, there's someone you think who's not very good at getting promoted above you.
You're listening to BBC Radio 5 on Monday, the 27th of August, 1990, as the clock ticks towards the launch of Britain's first new national network in 23 years on 909 and 693 AM.
Andy Parfitt got in touch and said they were setting up Radio 5, as it was then, not Radio 5 Live, with Morning Edition. And he said, "We're looking for a Hong Kong correspondent." So I did that for a couple of years. So I thought if I was going to leave Hong Kong, maybe Radio 5 was the type of place I'd go to, or World Service, not commercial radio. Yeah, I was happy in Hong Kong, but the thing, I think taking on the role of running the station and wanting to stay on air was just a little bit too much. Also, I was the wrong age, because I was getting on for 45, and I thought if I stay for 5 years until the handover to China, which would have been exciting from a broadcast point of view, I would be 50. And then if there was no freedom of speech and I wanted to leave, or had to leave, 50 is not a good time to get a job. And so I came back in March of 92, had lunch with Andy Parfitt, but he said, "Well, things aren't going too well at Radio 5. I'm just about to go to Radio 1. So that was a non-starter. But I knew Paul Brown, who was head of regulation at the Broadcast Authority. I knew him because we worked together at BFPS Gibraltar. He put me in touch with various people, including LBC and a station on the South Coast, and Ralph Bernard. And Paul Brown said that Ralph Bernard is setting up this station called Classic FM, so why not have words with him? So I did, and we got on very well. And I remember Ralph saying, in my attitude of classical music, I always thought it was stuffily presented and very snobby. And he said, "Oh, well, this is music to my ears." And then I met Nicholas Trezillian, and I gave him a tape. And for whatever reason, I went back to Hong Kong and resigned. So there was a month to go before my contract ended. And I was getting a little worried because I hadn't heard from anybody where I'd put feelers out, in particular Classic FM. But one day, I think I'd just been involved in an outside broadcast and my phone went at home. And it was Anna Gregory, who was the head of music and assistant to the programme controller. And she said, oh, the programme controller is very interested in seeing you. He likes your tape, but he'd like to interview you. And I said, well, what's his name? And she said, Michael Buck. And my heart sank. Because going back to that interview I had at Capital, I thought, oh, dear. I went back for the weekend, had my interview with Michael, and he's a very impetuous man. We agreed a deal. And he said, I want you to start on such and such a date. And I said, well, the thing is, I've already booked a five-week holiday. You're not due on air till September, and I can be with you by, you know, mid-July. He said, you know, take it or leave it, sunshine. If you want the job, you know, this is what you have to do. He said, I had to cancel a holiday to Greece, so tough. So I had to rearrange my holiday, lost some money on it, and on the Monday started work at Classic FM. So this was July in 92. When even the microphones weren't there. The premises then were in Camden Town, in the basement of what was the old Gilby's Gin boiler room. Quite a nice area. I like Camden Town. It's sort of very raffish. I don't know who chose it, but it was very much sort of Michael Street, I would have thought. But I remember the very first meeting. Michael said, we've got everybody except our drive time presenter. He said the person we had in mind, and I've never to this day have found out who that was, the person we had in mind was asking for too much. I don't think the person he had in mind was. I think it was his agent was. And he wanted this, he wanted that. So in the end, he told him to F off. So we had these meetings, and I got to know Michael and got to like him because he was very tempestuous. He was a bully in a way, but he bullied fairly, if I can say that. I was terrified of him, really, because we had to do these dummy runs, and I found him quite intimidating. We got through it. Eventually, microphones were installed. It was the first fully computerised radio station in the country, and I'm hopeless with computers, as indeed was Henry Kelly. So that led to a lot of problems in the initial stages. I think by the time we were due to go on air, we had rehearsed those first programmes enough to be fairly confident. And Michael Buck did everything on the hoof because he had no research to go on. They researched the sort of person who'd be listening, and they realised that the sort of person who'd be listening would be a Radio 4 listener, typically. And in the early stages, that was our greatest rival. They had worked out that people would listen to Radio 4 for the news and then want something more relaxing and turn on Classic FM, and that's exactly what happened. So what was going to be the first piece of music? That wasn't researched. There was no panel. There was no meeting. Michael just shouted across the room to Anna Gregory and the few other people who were listening, including me, that it was going to be Zadok the Priest by Handel. But a very, very good choice, because Handel became an adopted Englishman. It's choral, and we have a great choral tradition. And it was just an inspired choice. The irony now is that and for some years, I don't think we play any choral music at breakfast because it doesn't trail well, you know, when they do these focus groups. So that's an irony. But that's the piece of music we chose, and I think it was a very, very good one. First day, well, I remember doing the breakfast show. Of course, I had to be one of the first there. There was not many people in the building. In fact, Gillian Reynolds, the radio critic, I don't know how long she'd been there, but she'd been there for some time. So she was there when I arrived. I think she was the only person I saw. And there was a feeling of calm. I believe there had been terrible, terrible problems with BT and them threatening to pull the plug, but I wasn't aware of any of that. I suppose what hadn't been decided was, what was I going to say? What were the opening words? And again, we had no meetings really about it. I think Michael, some days before, had been sort of worried about it. But it was left up in the air. And eventually, 10 minutes before I went on air, he said, well, say what you like. But I realised that there needed to be a soundbite of about 30 seconds. And in that soundbite, I needed to get various things in, like Classic FM, like the first national commercial radio station in Britain, my name, and the first piece of music. It made it a little bit awkward because the newsreader, who was Sarah Shepherd, who I've never heard of since, very good newsreader, finished, as we still do, well, in those days it was Classic FM, the time is X, so it would have been 6:05. So I didn't then want to do a double announcement and say, well, this is Classic FM. So I think I just changed things around. And I said, good morning and welcome to Britain's first national commercial radio station. This is Classic FM.
I'm Nick Bailey. And this is George Frederick Handel.
I elongated the Handel to give him his full name. Sometimes people call him Friedrich, but as he was an adopted Englishman, I call him Frederick. And that was that. And it was used on BBC Radio 4. They used the whole clip. And that's the clip that people use now. So as far as I'm concerned, it had everything in. With any opening of a radio station, you just have to get that first link right, don't you? Once that happened, I wouldn't say it was plain sailing, but I felt confident. And Michael Bucht had instilled in us, you know, if you make a mistake, of which there were quite a few in those first few weeks, you know, as long as you get away with it with confidence and explain what's happening, the audience will be with you. And I think I made a couple of mistakes on that first broadcast, but nothing that was serious, and I had the confidence to get over it. Michael had always wanted, going back to his Capital days, had always wanted a classical station that was presented in a pop manner. And I think some of the things he wanted to do, we managed to persuade him not to. They were too poppy. But the main thrust was correct. What he said was, when he was employing broadcasters, he didn't want anyone with a music degree. He didn't want ex-Radio 3 people. He didn't want us to sound like, as he thought Radio 3 sounded, as if we were giving lectures at night classes. And he wanted the whole thing to flow. And his mantra was smile, segue and shut up.
I think the idea that license fee paid radio is public service and the other is not is fundamentally flawed.
The boss, the managing director, was a chap called John Spearman. And I think he liked to use the phrase intelligently irreverent, but not stupidly so. And it caught on. I think what happened was we attracted a lot of people who normally wouldn't listen to classical music, and they were very surprised with what they heard, because the whole premise for setting up Classic FM in the first place, well, first of all, if I can backtrack a bit, they could see a gap in the market because a lot of films using classical music, a lot of commercials using classical music. It was subliminal. So people were listening to classical music, who would probably say, oh, I don't like classical music, but actually think, oh, that's a good tune. So we were grabbing all these people. It was interesting, the professionals, I had quite a few musician friends, and they would say quite openly, say, oh, it's a dreadful station, you're awful, you make all these mistakes. So I would say, well, why are you listening? And they were listening, obviously, for curiosity. But 6 months down the line, they were still listening, and listening to us in preference to Radio 3. The press response was pretty good. We had also, yes, apart from Gillian, there was Nick Higham there, but he was really doing straight reporting. So that was a little bit nerve-wracking because they were filming my opening link through the glass. I realised this was being recorded for posterity, and if I made a mistake, you know, it would be there for posterity. But no, the press reaction was pretty good. Gillian Reynolds said there were a few mistakes, particularly with Henry Kelly, I think, on the engineering side. Not so much with me. I made a joke about Holst, which I don't know whether she liked or not, but I mean, there was nothing really that you could say was disparaging. The response really came much later, after our first ratings, which was after 3 months of our first radar, when we had established already 4.3 million listeners, which led to an editorial in the Times saying, isn't this fantastic? And it feels that Classic FM has always been there, and this is a commercial enterprise providing music for the people and all that sort of thing. And I think with those figures, there was no negative publicity, and very little negative publicity before that. And in fact, we got so much publicity before we even opened because of the Birdsong, which was the inspiration of our chief engineer, Quentin Howard, recorded in his garden. But that got a lot of people talking and a lot of publicity. And I heard that originally there was going to be £250,000 advertising campaign, which they dropped because they didn't need it. And I remember my father saying to my mother, he says, Classic FM couldn't have got more publicity. Some of it was negative from the point of view, oh, this is going to be terrible, you know, it's going to be in bite-sized chunks. without actually having heard it. But it was talked about. It was talked about in all the media. I think what's interesting, the audience was with us, warts and all, with all the mistakes we made, both technical and from a pronunciation or playing the wrong tracks. They sort of thought, yeah, okay. After 6 months, though, I felt sorry for people who took over from Henry or took over from me, because they would make the same mistakes. But by that stage, the audience had lost patience. I must tell you about, with Michael Bucht, was his management style. I don't think he ever slept, because whatever shift one did, he'd be on the phone. And he installed in the studio what became known as the Bucht phone, with an enormous light. And we were all terrified of it. And it was like being hounded by paparazzi. And you'd say something and this light would go on. And it was terrifying, certainly for the first few weeks. But then after a while, he would start to ring up to say, oh, that was good, or I like that joke, or try and top the joke himself. But that was his style. He had incredible energy, loads of ideas. I can't think of anybody else who could have started it, to be honest. Great admiration for the man, and we all did. I've always loved doing breakfast shows, and to do a breakfast show playing classical music. And the breakfast show had more than its fair share of Baroque music, and I like Baroque. And Baroque was seen to be the favourite genre with the younger audience, because it has a sort of pop beat. Here I was on a national radio station doing the breakfast show, playing my favourite sort of music, and playing them in bite-sized chunks, I suppose, which I didn't mind at all, and keeping things reasonably concise. And I did terrible things. I mean, I remember playing, I said, this is going to be a piece of piano music played by Christina Ortiz, and I played something completely different. I hadn't realised I'd done it, because it was so intense, all the research we had to do and all the learning the pronunciation. So with Christina Ortiz, it was something I had back announced it, hadn't realised I'd done it, and she faxed in and said, you know, what is happening? I then apologised the next day, and she then got back in touch and said, thank you so much, and by the way, I think you're all doing a fantastic job. I did a competition called Bailey's Breakfast Bonanza, and in those days there was no email and everything was sent in by post, and we used to get thousands and thousands sent in by post. And those days have gone, like that sort of excitement has gone, because email is fine, but it's not the same. You know, I remember Michael Bucht saying to me, and coming with another sack of mail, he said, I think you've cracked it, which was lovely. I mean, I know that Terry Waite used to listen to me and would write in and say that he was listening. I know Kim Wilde, I used to do a programme called Classic Romance, and Kim Wilde wrote in with her story, which I think won the Star Prize. So it was actually, that was quite nice to get. It wasn't a celebrity Classic Romance, it was just she listened to the programme. I know Princess Alexandra was a great fan of Classic Romance. I'm getting off the breakfast show now. But she, I think, at a cocktail party had said, oh, I really like that Classic Romance that Nick Bailey does. You know, so that's nice. I did the breakfast show for 3.5 years. And if I go back to the beginning, when they had those first ratings, and I was doing Classic Romance in conjunction with the breakfast show, so I was working 6 days a week, and Classic Romance was incredibly popular, the most popular programme on the station. I mean, it was Sunday morning after all, but it was the most popular programme. I think if I hadn't had that up my sleeve, Michael Bucht would have been disappointed with the breakfast figures. I think he was disappointed with the breakfast figures, but he said, look at the figures that Nick's got on Sunday, so it's not his fault. And they realised fairly soon after they launched that the breakfast show wasn't going to be the top programme. It was going to be the next one, which was Henry Kelly. Not so much because of Henry, but because that was when the Today programme stopped. And even now, with Classic FM, the breakfast show is number 4, which is totally unlike any other radio station. But they were worried about the breakfast show figures, because they remained fairly static. I mean, they were healthy, but they were static. And they thought, well, maybe if we bring a name in, that will make a difference. And so they decided on Mike Reed, who had done a few sit-in shifts. He did the show and he did very well, I think, initially. But then that sort of tailed off. So I came off in March of 96, I think. Luckily for me, I'd just been put on a 2-year contract. And I was still doing classical romance. And then I was put on sit-in, you know, I was sitting in here, then, everywhere. And then a chap called Alan Mann did it for 6 months. But in the meantime, management changed. Michael Butt left. He resigned on grounds of ill health in 97. And GWR took a stronger hold on, although it was set up by Ralph Bernard in the first place, they came in and had more of a hold on it on a day-to-day basis. And Steve Orchard took over temporarily as programme director. So I was put back on The Breakfast Show, and the programmes were restructured. A lot of great new ideas were brought in by Steve Orchard, which are still there, like Requests. And they brought in David Meller, I think, at that stage. And Simon Bates was doing a film programme. You know, quite a few initiatives. And I remained doing The Breakfast Show at that time, 6 to 8, for about another 3.5 years. But then they decided to downgrade me, if you like, and I was still doing The Breakfast Show, but I was doing not 6 to 8, but 5 to 7. And I did that for about a year. And then, by this time, Roger Lewis was the boss. He wanted me to do the what was then called the evening concert and be the first presenter to present it live. It had started with John Julius Norwich, I think, and then Nicholas Trezillian did it for a while. No, Richard Baker did it for a while. Nicholas Trezillian did it for a long time. And then they wanted me. So that was considered the sort of intellectual, prestigious end of Classic FM, because this is where things were played in their entirety. The programme is now called The Full Works. And I did that for about 5 years, 5-6 years maybe. And then things went terribly wrong, because by this stage we'd been in Camden Town, we'd moved to Oxford Circus, where we had Classic FM House, and then there was the merger, the ill-fated merger with Capital Radio, when it became GCAP, and things started to get out of hand in terms of the share price was plummeting. We just weren't making enough money. I think prior to us being taken over by Global, lots of drastic things had to be done, so a lot of staff were laid off. And some presenters went, and the person who'd been doing the overnight show for 14 years, Mark Griffiths, had to go. And Newsnight, which was the news programme, went. And John Brunning, who presented that, was on staff, and he was put on the evening concert. So he took over the programme I did, and I was put on overnight. This was in 2008. So I wasn't too happy about the prospect. You know, I was still getting the same money, but I could understand why it was done. My present wife was very understanding with the hours that I had to put in. I think they accept that that's what you do in radio. I certainly accepted it. I think if I'd had enough money, I would have said, well, thanks, but no thanks. But I was putting my children through university, and I just felt I couldn't. I wasn't in a position to say, no, I can't do it. I hated it for about a year, but then I sort of moulded it into my own programme, and I called it The Pumpkin Club, which I did. But that, because I love travel so much, was a fantastic, I mean, if you could get over the sleep pattern, was a fantastic programme to do, because it was peak in America, Canada, New Zealand, Australia, Hong Kong, and I used to get reports from all over the world, and that was brilliant. And it had, even in this country, it had 400,000. So it wasn't the you know, the big figures I'd been getting, but it was still a great programme to do. But I was going to say, in the meantime, I'd done a programme called Relaxing Classics at 2. And you were talking about, you know, famous people and so on. Well, the Duke of Edinburgh came into that programme. It was a media day for the royal family. The Queen was meant to come as well, but at the last moment, she decided to go elsewhere. And my programme was chosen for him to come. And he came in, and the Duke of Edinburgh is exactly as it says on the tin. You know, he's very brusque. But I love him for it, really. And I asked him off-air whether he listened to Classic FM, and he said, well, yes, he does listen, he said, when he's a fugitive from Radio 4. And I said, oh, do you ever listen to this programme, Relaxing Classics at 2? And he said, yes, I do. But I have to just say before I go on, that Relaxing Classics at 2 had just the one theme, which was played throughout the programme. Very catchy theme, but maybe played once too often. I don't know what the theme was. I think it was some library music, but it was a catchy piece of music. And the Duke of Edinburgh, in reply to my question, said, yes, I do listen, but I wish you'd change that bloody jingle. So But he stayed for about half an hour, so, you know, that was great. And eventually when I decided to give up the overnights, they said, well, could I come back and do daytime fill-ins at my convenience? And I was doing a lot of travelling, because since 2004 I've been hosting music cruises for P&O. And for the last 2 years I've been giving talks on P&O cruise ships as well. So, no, I really have no regrets. And because it was such a nice worldwide audience, in a way that compensated. I think when I was first taken off the breakfast show in 96, that hit me the hardest, I think, actually. After that, I didn't really mind. I mean, you get older and wiser, don't you? And Classic Romance, I suppose, was the programme that I'm most proud of, because I put a lot of effort into that. I eventually produced it, and it had such a big audience. I mean, over 1 million, really, from the word go. And I wasn't the first choice for that. I mean, that came about by accident, because Michael Bucht had Tom Conti in mind, but he couldn't make it. And then Michael tried to get Joanna Lumley, and she couldn't do it, or didn't want to do it. And then time was running out. So he said, I want you to do it. And Michael was very pleased with the first week. And he said, you know, I didn't think we'd get people writing. I thought we'd have to invent the letters, but we didn't have to do that. And he said, we're still looking for someone. Can you do it for another week? And I didn't really want to, because doing the breakfast show was enough. But I did it for a second week. And then after the second week, he said, oh, don't worry, we've got Nigel Havers to do it. But he can't do it till the end of October. At the end of the third week, he said, I want you to do it full time, which I did for 7 years. And that was a sort of great programme to do. And it became, I was asked to be part of a BBC play in Scotland that incorporated it. Peak Practice used it in a scene. You know, it was one of those iconic programmes. But eventually it went to Simon Bates, and he did it for a year, and then it sort of fizzled out, really. I mean, as all programmes do.
And can I thank you all for listening for the last 25 years. And although I haven't met most of you, I consider you as friends.
Sad in many ways, because, I mean, I went out on my own terms. It had been decided that on the 25th anniversary that I would read the news all morning, which was a good end to my radio career as I started doing news. But also worked well for Classic, because it was the newsreader's job to give all the stories on the 25th anniversary. And also I transcended. I was on the breakfast show with Tim Leoro, and also on the next show with John Suchet. So I did from 6 right through till 12, and they replayed my opening link, and they played Zadok and so on. So it was a good way to go out.
Good morning and welcome to Britain's first national commercial radio station.
I think I was beginning to feel a little bit restricted with my travels. Also, I felt I had to just keep up to date with all the emails all the time, because things changed often in radio. But I was very glad to walk out with my head held high. I feel I can go back any time, and I have no regrets. And I had a wonderful 25 years, some great colleagues, great listeners, and great music. I'd like to write a book. It's just a matter of getting a publisher, which is From Radio Caroline to Classic FM. And the talks I gave just a few weeks ago, there was one on Radio Caroline, one on, one I called from a £10 pom to a boss in Hong Kong, and the last one was on Classic FM, the first 25 years. So I'd like to write a book. I'd like to still do more travelling. I don't miss actually being on air. I would miss not broadcasting at all. I still do the classical programme for British Airways, but that's not live. But I enjoy doing that. I'm always open for offers. I suppose, in radio terms, I'll always be remembered as the first voice on Classic FM. But I would also like to be remembered as a sort of globe-trotting broadcaster who was prepared to take risks.